Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Silicon Valley Forum of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from Hyatt Ricky's in Palo Alto. I am Bob Saldick, former CEO of Raychem and a member of the Advisory Council of the Silicon Valley Forum and your chair for today. We also welcome the listeners of WDPS in Athens, Ohio, one of more than 225 radio stations nationwide carrying America's longest-running radio program. We invite all of our listeners here and on the radio to visit us on the Internet at www.commonwealth.org. And now for today's speaker. Tom Friedman is one of my real heroes. He is, by any measure, one of America's leading interpreters of world affairs. Born in Minneapolis in 1953, he was educated at Brandeis University and at St. Anthony's College, Oxford. His first marvelous book, From Beirut to Jerusalem, won the National Book Award in 1988. Mr. Friedman has also won two Pulitzer Prizes for his reporting for the New York Times as bureau chief in Beirut and in Jerusalem. After assignments as the New York Times chief diplomatic correspondent and their international economics correspondent, he was appointed in 1995 as the New York Times foreign affairs columnist, only the fifth person to hold that post in the paper's history. On April 21st, just a few days ago, his new book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, was published to early critical acclaim. We welcome Tom Friedman to the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you. Thank you. Put this hammer down if that's okay. Don't want to hurt myself. Thank you all for being here, and thank you for having me. I've been looking forward a long time to speaking to this group here in Silicon Valley. I always like to begin the discussion of my book by talking a little bit about my job as the foreign affairs columnist for the Times, because that's really where the from which the book emerged. And I always like to say that I have the best job in the world. Somebody has to have it. I've got it, and you don't. I get to be the what I call a tourist with an attitude. I get to travel around the world and tour and see and meet all sorts of people and have attitudes about what I see and hear. There's only one downside to this job. Actually, there's two downsides. I have to have attitudes twice a week. In fact, I have to have those attitudes on every Tuesday and every Friday. And so the big challenge in doing this job is what attitudes? What attitudes? As Bob said, I'm the fifth foreign affairs columnist in the history of the Times. The first was a woman, Anne O'Hare McCormick. And Anne McCormick, according to her highly politically incorrect obit in the New York Times, got her start, according to the Times, accompanying her husband, who was an engineer from Dayton, Ohio, on buying trips to Europe. And she started stringing for the Times. This was in the 1930s. And her super story, the framework within which she organized her opinions, was really Versailles Europe crumbling and pre-World War II. Her successors, actually her column, I should note, was called In Europe, because In Europe was foreign affairs in those days for the readers of the New York Times. As some of you may know, I began my column in Tokyo, and as a deliberate statement of 60 years later where the direction of the New York Times readers might be better located. Her successors had World War II as their framework, as their super story, and then their successors had the Cold War as their framework and super story. I came along in 1995 when the Cold War had ended, and the big question for me was, what is the super story out there? What is kind of the overarching international system within which I would organize my column? And basically, what this book is about is the system out there as I see it. Now, the simple thesis of this book can be reduced to the following. For the last 10 years, we have been speaking about the post-Cold War world. We have been describing the world by what it isn't because we didn't know what it was. So we called it the post-Cold War world. This book is an argument for what I think it is. And the argument is that globalization is not a trend. It's not an economic fad. It's not a Nintendo game. It is nothing more and nothing less than the international system that replaced the Cold War system. And like the Cold War system, it shapes everyone's domestic politics and everyone's international relations directly or indirectly. And you cannot see the world unless you see it through the lens of this system. Now, the Cold War system was characterized by a single word, division. The world was a divided space, and it was symbolized by a single word, the wall. And all your threats and opportunities in this system grew out of who you were divided from. The globalization system is also characterized by a single word, integration. And all your threats and opportunities in this system flow from who you're connected to. And it's also symbolized by a single word, the web. So we've gone from a world of division and wall to a world of integration and web. In the Cold War, we reached for the hotline, which was a symbol that we were all divided, but two people were in charge, the U.S. and the USSR. And in the globalization system, we reach for the internet, which is a symbol that we're all connected and nobody's in charge. We are all connected and nobody is in charge. If you want a simple metaphor for this system, it truly is the internet. Now, these systems have very different characteristics, as I try to outline in the book. If the Cold War had been a sport, it would have been sumo wrestling. Two big fat guys in a ring. Lots of ritual grunting and stomping around. Not a lot of contact, though, till the very end when one fat guy pushes the other fat guy out of the ring. If globalization were a sport, it would be the 100-yard dash over and over and over. And if you lose by 1/100th of a second, it's like you lost by a week. The Cold War was about weight. Globalization is about speed. The Cold War was about E equals MC squared. Globalization is about Moore's law that the speed of microchips will double every 18 to 24 months. The ideal document in the Cold War was the treaty. The ideal document in globalization is the deal. The ideal defense mechanism in the Cold War was radar to protect you from the threat coming from the other side of the wall. The ideal defense mechanism in globalization is the X-ray machine to protect you from the threat from within. Two very, very different systems. Now, what characterizes the most important aspects of these systems are two other points, which I'll go through. The ideal economists for the Cold War were Marx and Keynes. They wanted to tame capitalism. The ideal economists for the globalization era are Schumpeter and Andy Grove. Okay, and that's a central argument of this book. Schumpeter, who believed that capitalism was about creative destruction, the ability of a society to shoot the wounded, take their dead capital, and reassign it to more efficient producers more quickly. And Andy Grove, who understood that and took the title of his book from Schumpeter's insight that only the paranoid survive. The second aspect of this system, which makes it so much more complex to understand and analyze, is the following. The Cold War system, and you could read the morning paper and understand it as such, the Cold War system was a system built around states. People interacted with the world through their state. And the story on the front page of the newspaper, as far as international relations was concerned, was a story of states balancing states, states contending with states. It was Russia, you know, versus the United States, China versus Japan, etc. What characterizes the globalization system is instead of it just being built on one balance, states and states, it's built, on three balances. And this is what makes it so complex both to analyze and to understand. The globalization system, first of all, is built on states. States balancing states. Russia balancing NATO, NATO balancing Russia, China balancing Japan still matters and is still news, rightly so, on the front page of our papers. What characterizes this system, though, are two new balances that are fundamentally important. The first is the balance between states and supermarkets. Within this system now, for reasons which I'll explain later, you have now 25 or so supermarkets. These are the 25 largest stock and bond markets around the world that themselves have become autonomous power players in the international system. Who brought down Suharto in Indonesia? It was not another state. It was the supermarkets. So now we have states and states, states and supermarkets. Lastly, and most interestingly, what you have in this system is also a balance between states and what I call super-empowered individuals. What happens in a system without walls, built on networks, is that individuals can become super-empowered and they can act on the world unmediated by a state. Now, there are super-empowered nice people. Jody Williams won the Nobel Peace Prize for organizing a global ban on landmines against the wishes of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, against the wishes of the five most powerful countries in the world. When asked, how did you do that, she said, email. She basically used a global email network to galvanize enough support around the world to trump the five permanent members of the UN Security Council. George Soros was a super-empowered financier. He broke the British pound 4 years ago. He took on a state. Lastly, and most troubling in this system, though, you don't just have super-empowered good people. You also have what I call in the book the super-empowered angry men. Osama bin Laden, the man who was responsible for blowing up the U.S. embassies in Africa, took on the United States. He had his own network, Jihad Online, basically, and he took on the United States. And the United States fired 16 cruise missiles at Osama bin Laden. That is certainly the first time in history the United States has ever fired a cruise missile at a person. But Osama bin Laden had become super empowered. Now, another example of this, and I go into him in more detail in the book because the case always intrigued me, was Ramzi Youssef, the man who wanted to blow up the World Trade Center, wanted to blow up the two tallest buildings in America. I was always curious about him, so I went back into the court records because I always wanted to know, what did Ramzi Youssef want? After all, he did try to blow up the two tallest buildings in America. Did he want a Palestinian state in Brooklyn? Did he want an Islamic Republic in New Jersey? What he wanted was to blow up the two tallest buildings in America. Period, paragraph, end it. Globalization, on the one hand, again, for reasons I'll talk about later, had gotten in his face, and globalization had empowered him as an individual to do something about it. And the FBI cracked the case of Ramzi Youssef how? By tracking him to an apartment in the Philippines where they found all his plots on the C drive of his Toshiba laptop. He was a super-empowered, angry man. What is scary about this system is not that Ramzi Youssef can ever be a superpower. It is how many people can be Ramzi Youssef. Now let's talk about the system, how it works, and where it came from. And here let me make a caveat, which I've now learned in doing these public speaking events that I have to do. I find, from a purely analytical point of view, and I've got some friends here who know this all too well, I get very excited at the analytical level of describing and discovering something new. And I really enjoy sharing it with you. But as all the early reviews of this book will indicate, and if you read it yourself, do not mistake my enthusiasm for describing this system and understanding it for any endorsement of it one way or another. There are aspects of it that I admire and I encourage, and there are aspects of it that I find deeply troubling. Caveat emptor. Now, the first question, the question my daughters might ask me, is, well, Daddy, if the system of globalization is built on a world without walls, what blew away the walls? Where did globalization come from? Now, as someone out here will surely ask, as someone asks at every event, this is not the first era of globalization we've been through. And what I try to explain in the introduction of the book is we went through a similar era in the 1800s up to World War I and the Great Depression. That era of globalization, I argue, shrunk the world from a size large to a size medium. This era is shrinking it from a size medium to a size small. It is a difference of degree that ultimately becomes a difference in kind. How did it happen? What blew away the walls? What I argue is what blew away the walls were three, I call them democratizations, three fundamental changes in how we interact with the world that were born in the Cold War system, were nurtured in that system, gained strength in that system, and ultimately came together at the end of the 1980s in such a powerful force that they blew away the walls. What were those? I'll go through them quickly. Obviously, I can only do it on a little bit of surface level. But the first is what I call the democratization of finance, basically. You know, there was nothing more anti-democratic in this country than bank lending in the 1950s. You had to have an in at the bank, basically, you know, to start a business or get any kind of loan. What has happened over the last 30, 40 years, basically, beginning with the creation of a commercial paper market, going right up through Michael Milken and the creation of the junk bond market, venture capitalism, culminating in David Bowie, the rock star, issuing $55 million in David Bowie bonds. Yes, you too can be rated AAA, okay? Is that finance in this country has gotten democratized. Access to capital has gotten democratized. The second democratization is the democratization of technology. And I don't have to waste any time with this group explaining what that means. Basically, through the process of digitization, thanks to the wizardry through which we, as Negroponte says, turn atoms now into bits, that we turn any kind of music, data, information into ones and zeros that we can transmit around the world and access now through our own home computers, technology got democratized. The third democratization was the democratization of information. Thanks to cell phones and satellites and fiber optics and faxes, we all now increasingly know how each other lives. The days when some Soviet newspaper could run a picture of Americans waiting outside of Zabar's Delicatessen in New York at 7 a.m. on a Saturday morning for it to open under the caption, "Look, breadlines in America, too." Okay. Don't try that trick at home, kids. Okay. Those days are over. Okay. We all now know how each other lives. Now, the best place to see these three democratizations embodied in one place is if you go to the E-Trade website. If you call up E-Trade or Charles Schwab, any of them, what do you see? Well, the first thing you see is that you can buy, sell, trade, swap, put or call any stock or bond currency in the world. Secondly, what you see is you can do it from your bedroom or your basement. And the third thing you'll see is that E-Trade will run you the analytics, will give you the information free, maybe the 10 best analyst reports on that stock, bond, or currency that a decade ago they would have either charged you for or reserved for their best clients. The democratization of finance, the democratization of information, the democratization of technology. What happened, I argue, at the end of the 1980s is that these three democratizations reached a critical mass in which blew away all the walls and created by creating an incredible set of new efficiencies in the marketplace and creating a whole new place to do business called cyberspace. These incredible new efficiencies, if you understood them, absorbed them, and as a country or company applied them to your business or your country, you thrived in this new era. If you didn't, the Berlin Wall fell on you. And the theme of this chapter, this whole section of the book, is that the fall, it is not an accident that IBM, General Motors, the Soviet Union, and East Germany all tanked at the same time. It is not a historical accident. They all got hit, basically, with these democratizations. They could not absorb them, each in their own way. And they could not respond quickly enough. And the only response is the deconcentration of power and the decentralization of information. They could not react quickly enough, and hence the Berlin Wall fell on all of them. Central thesis of this book is that the fall of the Berlin Wall was not a European event. It was a global event. Any bloated, sclerotic, overweight system, whether it was called IBM, General Motors, the Brazilian government, or the Soviet Union, got hit with these new efficiencies and either responded or did not. And those that didn't had the Berlin Wall fall on them. Now, the falling of walls then begins the first most important sort of impact of this system. And let me now talk about the moving parts of this system and how it works. When the walls get blown away, something fundamental happens, which is, as I say, central to the working of this system, and that is the barriers to entry into everybody's business collapse or are shrunk to a level we've never seen before. When the barriers to entry fall, what that means is the speed from which you move from innovation in whatever good or service or product you produce to commoditization, the speed from which you move from having a high value-added good or service to having that turned into a commodity that anyone else can make or sell and the only differentiation is price, the speed you move goes from 10 miles an hour in a world of walls to 110 miles an hour in a world without walls. And fasten your seatbelts and put your seatbacks and tray tables into a fixed upright position, because with the internet, it's going to go from 110 miles an hour to 210 miles an hour. And the best place to see this phenomena is in the ultimate world without walls, the world of internet competition and technology. At the Davos World Economic Forum this year, I attended a press breakfast with Bill Gates, and all the reporters there were asking him, Mr. Gates, all these internet stocks, it's a bubble, isn't it? I mean, they're all a bubble. I mean, they're a bubble, right? And he was saying, look, of course, you idiots, they're a bubble. Anyone who thinks they can project their earnings in the world of technology 10 years out is crazy. I don't even know if I'm going to be here in 4 years. But you're missing the point. Because the point is, this bubble is attracting so much new capital to this industry that it is going to drive innovation faster and faster. Well, that afternoon I went to interview President Mubarak of Egypt. And after the interview, I was sitting around with some Egyptian businessmen friends in Davos and an Egyptian journalist whom I've known for a long time. And this Egyptian journalist said to me, you know, Mr. Tom, we understand now we have to get on your globalization train. We understand that. But could you slow it down for us a little bit? You know, I said, hey, Matt, I'd love to slow it down, but there's nobody driving. In the morning, Bill Gates says this train is going to go faster and faster. In the afternoon, Imad says, I know I got to get on, but can you slow it down? And this is a real problem in this system, because when the walls get blown away, there's no more first world, second world, third world. There's just the fast world and the slow world. To have a third world, you need a third space, and to have a third space, you need walls. So either you can artificially construct those walls, like Mahathir did in Malaysia, okay? Otherwise, basically, you've either got to be in one world or not. Now, no whole country is entirely in the fast world. We have parts of this country, I'm sure parts of California, very much part of the slow world. But this is increasingly the dichotomy today. Now, when the barriers to entry fall, the following happens. We all start competing in each other's business. And I'm sure this is a popular phenomenon here. The way I like to explain this is I was riding on an airplane a while back, and I picked up the airline magazine, and there was an ad for the Sony Mavica camera. And the first thing I thought was, I didn't know Sony made cameras. I thought they made CDs and stereos. But, of course, in the age of digitization, Sony is just a digits company. I mean, all they do is transmit digits. They're used to transmitting music into digits and putting it on cylinders coated with aluminum called a CD. But if they do digits in a world without walls where everything can get digitized, why not be Kodak? Now, what was this ad? It's three pictures. The first is of the Sony Mavic camera. Under it, it says, this is your camera. Next to it is a 3.5-inch floppy disk. Under that, it says, this is your film. Next to that is a computer with a baby picture on it. Under that, it says, this is your post office. The real headline for this ad is that we are Sony, we are Kodak, we are Federal Express. So I'm thinking to myself as I read this ad, I wonder how the folks at Kodak feel about it. So I'm driving along one day, I hear an ad for Kodak, and they're advertising all their online computer services. So they've become a computer company. Then I go down to Houston to interview the people at Compaq Computer, actually, for this book, The Late Lamented, and which shows you how fast this system is, okay? Forbes magazine in 1998 rated Compaq the best-run company in America. That's not a joke. And it's still a good company. I went down there to interview the heads of Compaq, and I said, "See, how do you guys feel about Kodak?" You know, kind of talking like a computer company. They said, "We're not worried about Kodak because we now do business solutions." Oh, you do business solutions. In fact, you ever see a Compaq ad? They don't have any pictures of computers most of the time. They just say, "Compaq, better answers." Okay. So then I'm playing golf a few weeks later with a friend of mine. He works for PricewaterhouseCoopers. I said, "You know, I was just down in Houston. The folks at Compaq say they now do business solutions. I thought you did business solutions." He says, "We're not worried about Compaq, but we're worried about Goldman Sachs because they're now designing tax derivatives." So we talk about reading a book about it. I go home, tell my wife I'm going to go to Borders, get a book. She says, "Don't go to Borders, go to Borderless Books, Amazon.com. So I call up Amazon.com, and what's the first thing I see? They're now selling CDs. So I say, "Wasn't that Sony's business?" So I told this story to the booksellers of Farrar, Straus & Giroux, my publisher, when they were preparing to publish the book. Guy raises his hand. He says, "Mr. Friedman, I have to tell you something. I just came from Brooks Brothers department store. I was there to buy a suit in the men's suit department. I see a stack of Michael Jordan's books for sale for 30% off. I go up to the head of the department. I said, "How would you like it if I sold men's suits in my bookstores?" He said, "Have you looked at your Con Ed electric bill? They're offering the Jordan book for 40% off at Christmas, and you can charge it on your electric bill." We are all now in each other's business. And that's what really creates the intensity in this system. And that's where Schumpeter... And that's where Schumpeter and Andy Grove come in, because if for social, cultural, or political reasons, you are not good at shooting the wounded. You're Japan, and you like to put the wounded on respirators forever and ever and ever. Okay? You're going to have a real problem in this system in a world without walls. So that's the first thing, first element of this system to keep in mind. The second thing that gets created in this system is a new political garment. And I call that garment the golden straitjacket. Now, one of the underlying themes of this book is that when you kind of plug into this system, when your country goes global or your company goes global, but when your country goes global, it is the equivalent of taking your country public. It is like turning your country into a public company with shareholders abroad over whom you have no territorial, legal, or political control. What happens is you put on the golden straitjacket. The golden straitjacket embodies all the rules of neoliberal economics, which are the driving rules of this system. The original seamstress of the golden straitjacket was Margaret Thatcher in England. And when you put on the golden straitjacket, your country basically has to live up to all these rules of deficit to GDP ratios, inflation, deregulation and privatization, et cetera, et cetera. Two things happen when your country puts on the golden straitjacket. One is that it does produce gold. That is the upside of it, tends to be, highly and unequally, but it does produce gold. And so your economy grows. Your economy grows from more privatization, deregulation, foreign trade, competition, etc. Your economy grows and your politics shrinks. Your economy grows and your political choices narrow to Pepsi or Coke, to mere nuances, basically. Because in this system, it just will not allow you a range of political choice. What was the difference between Bob Dole and Bill Clinton? At the end of the day, Dole wanted to put some padding in the elbow. Clinton wanted to grow the middle a little bit. but it was really nuanced. John Major and Tony Blair in the British election, Patty Ashdown, the head of the third party in Britain, the Liberal Party, looked at Blair and Major and said, synchronized swimming. And I see synchronized swimming in every country today that has put on the golden straitjacket. There is something about this system that increases the consumer in us and truly impoverishes the citizen. And it's one of the really scary downsides of it. And that's one real feature of this golden straitjacket. Now, the third thing that gets created in this system is a new power source, what I call the electronic herd. The electronic herd is my term for all these global investors out there, and it's made up of Longhorn cattle, which are the big multinational companies, the Intels or the Compaqs, who come in and make a long-term commitment to your country with a factory and won't be in and out relatively quickly, and the Shorterhorn cattle, which are all these global investors, from people at home with their E-Trade websites to Merrill Lynch and Fuji Bank and Mitsubishi Bank and Bank of America. Today, they are a huge electronic herd. All these people existed in the Cold War system, but in that system of walls, this herd could never really gather together, graze wide enough, and grow powerful enough in a world with walls. But when the walls got blown away, suddenly this herd could graze in 180 different countries and gather together in these 25 kind of super markets. Because so many governments are now running balanced budgets under the demands of this system, it is increasingly the herd which becomes the energy source for countries to grow, whether they're companies or countries. You need to tap into that herd for the capital in order to grow your company or country. And it is the energy source today, and this leads to the fourth aspect of this system. What so much of international relations becomes about today in politics is how do I interact with that herd as a country or as a company? Now, I know some of you heard me say, let me just go through this. I compare countries to computers in this book, and I basically say that for the first time in history, it's as though we all have the same piece of hardware, free markets. For the first time in the world, everyone is using the same basic piece of hardware. China has free markets, and India has free markets. Russia has free markets, and Mexico has free markets. The question for international relations in so many areas is who will get the operating system and the software to go with that piece of hardware. Operating system are the basic macroeconomic rules of this system, and software, to me, involves rule of law, oversight, regulatory institutions, and ultimately democratic institutions. So you have software and operating system. Now, to me, Russia was like a piece of hardware plugged into this electronic herd with no operating system and no software inside. And when the herd surged, as it inevitably does, it melted down whatever tangled mess of wires was that Russian economy. Thailand, Korea, Malaysia, Indonesia were like pieces of hardware plugged into this herd, but with a very slow operating system, what I call DOS Kapital 1.0. Now, DOS Kapital 1.0 is great for getting your country from $500 per capita income to $5,000. But when you want to move from $5,000 to $10,000, and the herd moves from a 286 chip to a Pentium 3, and you're still using DOS Kapital 1.0, also known as crony capitalism, what happens? That little sign pops up on your computer, as it would at home, and it says you have misallocated all your resources, cannot move capital, please download new operating system and software. And that is what's going on in Southeast Asia today. Thailand, Malaysia, Korea, Indonesia are all involved in the struggle, and it is a struggle to basically upgrade their operating systems and their software. Now, let me deal with a few other aspects about this system on the more troubling side. The longest chapter in the book is a chapter called Demolition Man. It's a chapter that just as you have to interact with this electronic herd with the right operating system and software to manage its energy, get the best out of it, and cushion the worst in the financial sector, so you have to manage its flow in the environmental and cultural sectors as well. If you plug into this herd without any software in order to cushion with real surge protectors the energy that can come from it, it will burn a hole through your environment and culture faster than anything we've ever seen before in history. We are rapidly, if today 1.5 million people out of 1.5 billion people out of 6 billion people in the world today are living what we could call a globalization lifestyle, a lifestyle based on heavy consumption of petrochemicals, hydrocarbons, and bent metal. We are rapidly going from a world where 1.5 billion people are consuming those quite heavily to a world where 3 or 4 billion people will be doing so. And if we cannot learn to do more things with less stuff, we are going to rapidly, at a pace we've never seen before, junk up, pollute up, burn up this planet. And this chapter is just some rudimentary thoughts on what are the surge protectors one should think about as you interact with this herd. The title of the chapter comes from one of the worst movies ever made, a movie called Demolition Man, a Sylvester Stallone, Wesley Snipes movie, in which Sylvester Stallone and Wesley Snipes are two hardened. Sylvester Stallone is a cop, Wesley Snipes a hardened criminal. They are frozen in Los Angeles in the year 1982 in a cryo prison. It's actually a perversely brilliant movie. And they are unfrozen in the year 2032 in Los Angeles when globalization reigns. And every restaurant is a Taco Bell. And that's the theme of the movie. I actually got the idea for it because I had gone to Qatar on the Persian Gulf, a tiny Arab oil sheikdom on the east coast of Saudi Arabia. And the first day I was there, I took a long walk on the Corniche in Qatar. It's a beautiful Persian Gulf side sort of sidewalk, goes on for 15 miles, done just with beautiful taste. And you see there just every face and costume and color in Qatar. It's just a remarkable place. And I was walking along this corniche, and I was thinking to myself, you know, if there's an authentic Persian Gulf or Qatari place, this is really it. And I was just really enjoying my Qatari moment when I turned the corner and came upon Taco Bell, right in the middle of the Qatari corniche. And what's worse, it was crowded. Okay. And really, this chapter is about the idea that what happens in the incredibly homogenizing system that this is, if going around the world will be like going to the zoo and seeing the same animal in every cage, a stuffed animal. And that's a real concern out there. Thomas Wolfe said, you can't go home again. And one of my great fears in this era of globalization is that you won't be able to leave home again. That everywhere will start to look like everywhere else. And managing and preventing that, I think, is going to be one of the most serious issues about this system. A second real downside of this system has to do with the backlash against this system. And I begin that chapter in the book talking about a trip I took to Brazil last summer with Conservation International. And we visited a lot of the endangered environmental sites in Brazil. And one of them that they took me to was an Atlantic rainforest, a village in the Atlantic rainforest, where Conservation International had put out of business basically a village that was built on logging the rainforest. And there's only about 5% of the Atlantic rainforest left. And Conservation International, with the help of Intel and Budweiser and several global corporations, had built a tourist village, basically, a tourist site. It's a canopy walkway through the treetops of the Atlantic rainforest. And there's a hotel that's gone in there. And they're trying to build alternative employment for the people in this village. The village mayor, a guy named Dejar Birchner, who I talk about in the book, an old lumberjack. His great-grandfather was a logger. His father was a logger. His grandfather was a logger. The family owned two sawmills. Actually took us on the tour of the rainforest, and he knew every tree by its Brazilian species name. When we got done, we stopped at a rest stop in the middle of the rainforest. I took out my IBM ThinkPad, and I interviewed him for a half hour. We had a lovely talk, and he understood that, look, it was not sustainable anymore to log the rainforest. It was going to be gone. But Meanwhile, you know, he didn't really have many alternatives. So we had a very interesting chat. At the end of the interview, he said, we were talking through a translator in Portuguese. He said, I'd like to ask Mr. Friedman a question. Can I ask you a question? I said, sure, please, by all means. He said, do I have any future? Ooh, Jesus. I've never been asked a question like that in my entire reporting career. 40-year-old man asking me, do I have any future? At first, I was just taken aback. It almost brought tears to my eyes. And I gave him some answer about the need to educate his kids in the village and whatnot. We got done. He thanked me very much. He went to his car. Before he went to the car, I pulled the translator aside. I said, do me a favor. When you're alone with him at the car, ask him what he thought of my answer. So the translator came back after a few minutes, and he said, you know, the mayor basically, you know, repeated something that he said earlier and just wants you to know. When he gets to the office every day, he has 200 people there waiting for him, looking for jobs, housing, or food. If he can't provide them jobs, housing, or food, they're going to eat the rainforest, and they're not going to care. And that is the nature of this system. You know, Marxism, Leninism, revolutionary ideologies. I don't think this time in the backlash we're going to hear any of that. People are just going to eat the rainforest, each in their own way. In Indonesia, they'll rape the Chinese. In Russia, they'll sell nukes off the back of a truck. God only knows. But if we don't take care of this, the left behinds, the no-nots and the have-nots in this system, they can really and will really rise up against it. I actually sort of, in thinking about the mayor, I had just been to a technology conference in Tel Aviv, and I had been told something by an Israeli high-tech entrepreneur. He said, you know, in Silicon Valley, they have this expression that competition in their industry is a lot like the competition between the lion and the gazelle in the jungle, and that the lion goes to sleep every night in the jungle knowing one thing. In the morning, when the sun comes up, if it can't outrun the slowest gazelle, it's going to starve. And the gazelle goes to sleep knowing only one thing, that in the morning, if it can't outrun the fastest lion, it's going to be breakfast. But what they both know is that in the morning, when the sun comes up, they better start running. The problem is there are a lot of turtles out there. There are a lot of turtles. They aren't lions and they aren't gazelles. And if you don't take care of these people in this system, it is going to be one of the fundamental threats and challenges to it. Let me just finish with one last point, and then we'll open it up for questions. The penultimate chapter of the book is called If You'd Like to Speak to a Human Being, Press 1. And it's a chapter about what are the threats and dangers to this system more broadly. I really tried to answer analytically for myself the question, is this system irreversible? I mean, is it here to stay? And in that chapter, I talk about the issue of dealing with the have-nots and those, and I deal with the issue of homogenization. But in many ways, maybe the biggest threat to this system, and I'll just leave you at this point, is that what I call just too damn hard. That the first 10 years of this globalization system, if we date it from the fall of the Berlin Wall, the first 10 years have been about what happens if small countries can't make it. What happens if Algeria can't make it? What happens if Liberia can't make it? What happens if Yugoslavia can't make it? Well, what happens we now see is that the system builds an iron curtain around them, and we drive around these countries like they're a bad neighborhood. What this next decade of this system is going to be about, and let me interject one point here, and it's a fundamental argument again in the book. If this were the Cold War, we're in 1946, okay? We are just at the beginning of this system. Churchill just gave his Iron Curtain speech. We understand as much about how this system is really going to work as we understood about the Cold War in 1946. 10 years from now, people are going to look back at my book and say, God, that was an interesting first crack, but boy, did he get it wrong. You know, I have no doubt. We are just at the beginning, and what I've tried to write is the first crack at trying to look at this as a system. But I write this with great humility because I am keenly aware of how quickly things are changing in ways that I can't even begin to understand. The example I always love to give, in fact, are the two economists for long-term capital management, the gigantic Connecticut hedge fund that ran up, you know, enough debt, you know, more than all the foreign reserves of China, basically. The two economists who advised long-term capital management 1 year earlier won the Nobel Prize in economics. You know what they won it for? Risk management. They won the Nobel Prize in 1997, I believe, for risk management, and they won the Booby Prize in 1998 for running up the highest risk in the history of financial markets by any group of individuals. That should give us all pause that maybe we don't fully understand how this system works. It certainly leaves me humbled. In fact, I have a quote in the book from Alan Greenspan. It's a rare on-the-record quote in an interview, and he said, go ahead and use it. He said, I've learned more about how this system works in the last 12 months than I did in the previous 20 years. So we are just at the beginning of this, and this book is a first crack at trying to look at it as a system. Now, let me just continue where I left off. The first 10 years was about what if small countries can't make it. I believe what the next 10 years are going to be about is what happens if some big countries can't make it. What happens if China can't make it? What happens if Russia can't make it? What happens if Japan can't make it? The argument I make in the book is that we all grew up in an age where the biggest threats to us militarily were the strength of Russia and China and the economic strength of Japan. I believe my daughters, age 10 and 13, will grow up in a world where the biggest threats to them are going to be the weakness of Russia and China and the weakness of Japan as they go through the very wrenching process of adapting themselves to this system. Managing China's weakness, managing Russia's weakness, and managing Japan's weakness, I believe, are going to be central challenges, possibly the central challenge of American foreign policy. I end that chapter with a cartoon from The New Yorker. It's two Hell's Angels on motorcycles, and one Hell's Angel says to the other, say, how was your day? And the other Hell's Angel answers, well, advancing issues led to climbs. Okay. And that's about all I can say about this system. You know, I hope and pray that if we can keep advancing issues leading declines for more people in more places, more of the time, we will be doing God's work. That is America's mission. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Thomas Friedman. Tom asked me to tell you that he will be signing books after the after this session. Thank you, Tom, for the great talk. New York Times columnist, author of The Lexus and the Olive Tree. It is now time for our question and answer session. Conducting this question session will be Jerry Seppos. Jerry was recently promoted to Vice President for News at Knight Ridder after serving with the Mercury News since 1981 and as executive editor since 1995. My good friend, Jerry Seppos.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Bob Solik, our chair today. Tom, we have a lot of questions in a short time, so let us get started. And I'm going to take the liberty of asking the first question. Just about a year ago, you wrote a column that started this way, I don't think I like Silicon Valley. You went on to say that there's a disturbing tendency here toward Washington government and even the nation. There is no geography in Silicon Valley or geopolitics. There are only stock options and electrons. Some of our readers readers of the Mercury News didn't like that too much and wrote a number of letters to the editor. Actually, one, I think, was trying to make you feel good. He disagreed with you, but one, William Dixon of San Jose, did say, you know, Easterners are often abysmally ignorant of anything west of the Hudson River. Then he went on to make his point. So you're not alone. I hope you feel good about that. My question, does the rest of the nation really think that we're fooling ourselves here and that that we've got it wrong, we've got our priorities wrong, despite the number of references you made to technology?
It's a good question, Jared. Thank you very much. Let me give several sort of scattershot answers to that. I believe, and this is what the last chapter of the book is about, and I believe that we are the biggest beneficiaries of this system, we America, and we have to understand that. We are the biggest beneficiaries of this system, and therefore we have an inordinate role and responsibility to preserve this system. And this system, all this integration, all this interneting, all of this globalization and free trade from which so many people here and in other parts of this country benefit, it's not happening in a vacuum. It's happening within a power structure. It's happening in a world stabilized by a benign superpower called the United States of America, with something called the U.S. Air Force, the U.S. Army, the U.S. Marine Corps, and the U.S. Navy, paid for with U.S. tax dollars. And we have to understand that, that this system isn't self-perpetuating. Good ideas also need to be wedded to power. You know, when the Soviet Union was strong, its bad ideas had a lot of currency. And the point I was making in that piece is I think people have to remember that, that without the hidden fist, the hidden hand won't work. And I think we always have to keep that in mind. I would say, secondly, I think what Washington is going to have to keep in mind, and we're starting to see this a little bit around Kosovo, is the fact that we are going to need a new consensus, a new coalition to support American internationalism today. The old coalition that supported it was this so-called Eastern establishment. It doesn't exist anymore. And the only coalition that can support it today is got to be a coalition based on, you know, the internet manufacturers and the software designers of Silicon Valley, with the farmers of the Midwest, with the you know, Amnesty International and human rights advocates of Manhattan, with you know, the export workers of Dallas, Texas. We need a new coalition to support American internationalism, because people who are hurt by globalization, they know exactly who they are. But people who are benefited from it rarely have any idea who they are. I don't think anyone, a worker at Hewlett-Packard, ever got up in the morning and said, boy, thank God I work here and that we have free trade and open markets, and therefore there's huge demand for my products here, and my boss had to give me a raise because of the competition for knowledge workers. Ain't globalization great? I don't think anybody ever said that here. But someone who loses their job and they perceive it's because of this system, they know exactly who they are. They are well mobilized and understandably well motivated to do something about it. And therefore, the people who benefit from this system have to be keenly aware of that.
Interesting, and a follow to that, really, from the audience. You stated in your speech that we're in an era when no one is in charge. Who do you think has the most influence in this integrated world? And the writer wrote, is it multinational companies like Intel, Coke, Netscape, I mean AOL? Is it Bill Gates? Is it Alan Greenspan? Is it Japan? Or is it a combination of these influences?
Well, there's no question that we are first among equals, the United States. There's absolutely no question about that. But I go back to my three balances, you know, state-state, state-supermarket, state-super-empowered individual. And the fact is, what makes this system so complex is the fact that you have all three now in action, balancing themselves. I did an interview with the NPR station in San Francisco this morning, and with a very good interviewer, a thoughtful woman, and she was telling me that her daughter is in communication over the internet with a young girl in Serbia. And this young girl in Serbia is telling her, like, about the war and what's going on. And she was saying it not only has changed her daughter's view of the internet, but it's deeply affecting her view of the war, in fact, of war in general. And, you know, managing a system now like this is just extremely complex. It takes a lot of delicate balancing in a lot of areas. Pick up the San Jose paper. The lead on any given day in the last 2 weeks, I would bet, Jerry, is that about 1.3 billion people, million people in Kosovo fighting over who owns which olive tree. And the off-lead, I would bet dollars to donuts, was about 1.3 billion people in China trying to figure out whether they should join the World Trade Organization. And both are going on at the same time. That's why the book is called The Lexus and the Olive Tree. And you know, how you manage that and keep them in balance and not letting one trump the other is extremely complicated. And but the beginning of wisdom, I that's why I wanted to write this book, is to get your arms around it and to understand that we are – I'm not saying – claiming here that the world has fundamentally changed. We've reinvented everything. But I am a believer in international systems. I believe this is a different international system. It has different moving parts. And the beginning of wisdom for learning how to deal with it is first learning how to see it.
A number of people mentioned the conflict over the olive tree. One tied it in with globalization and said, how can ethnic cleansing be occurring in an era of globalization when we are all connected and know how each other lives?
It's a good question. And again, you know, what this book is about. Yeah, I begin the book with a discussion of a passage that my own theology teacher, Zvi Marks, pointed out to me. It's from Genesis. It's one of the oldest story. It's about Cain slaying Abel. And if you read the Hebrew Bible and you read the passage in Genesis about Cain slaying Abel, it basically says they went out to the field, they had a conversation, I don't have the words here, and Cain slew Abel. But what it doesn't say is what happened in that conversation? What happened in that conversation that Cain got so upset that he slew Abel? What were they talking about? Well, the rabbis had basically three interpretations. One interpretation is that, you know, one of them was a keeper of sheep, the other was a tiller of the land. They were arguing over economic development because one said to the other, get your sheep off my land. They were arguing over resources and economic development. They're arguing over modernization. Second interpretation is that they were arguing over Eve. They're arguing over the one woman in the world. They're arguing over procreation and the human sexual drive. The third interpretation is that they got in an argument over who would have the temple basically in their backyard. Who would be the keeper of the family seals? Who would be the keeper of the family olive tree? Who would be the keeper of the family identity? They were arguing about issues of identity and community. And you have in that story, the rabbis noted, basically all of the three animating impulses of human behavior and interaction. You have the struggle over modernization, the struggle over identity, and the struggle over sex. As I say in the introduction of this book, I will leave sex to somebody else. And my book is about the other two. Now, what is new and what the Lexus represents, what this globalization system I'm talking about represents, is something really very old. It's just, it is this struggle for development, modernization, higher living standards in a new system. What is old is this struggle over who owns which olive tree and where is it going to go, which is a deeply important struggle because olive trees are what root us and anchor us and provide us the warmth of family and community. And it's what you're seeing today, the drama of the front page of the paper is this very old struggle over who owns which olive tree, bumping up against also a very old struggle, this quest for modernization and economic development, but expressed in a new system called globalization. And it's the tension between the two. And you can see this struggle in Kosovo today. I mean, I'm the last believer, it seems, among Washington pundits who actually believes the air war is going to work. Because I look at Yugoslavia and I see a modern European state. And Lord knows I don't enjoy seeing them pulverized any more than I enjoy seeing the Kosovars ethnically cleansed. But I believe that with enough pressure, this modern European state at some point is going to say, we don't want to abandon that quest for we don't want to be set back 100 years or 200 years. And ultimately, that's going to bring them around. I may be wrong. I mean, who knows? But that is my gut instinct. And it's certainly going to be an interesting test. But what we can all agree on is that's the drama today.
One more Kosovo-related question. Europeans complain that the U.S. insists on a leadership position, or maybe it should be the leadership position, in international affairs. Are there times when the U.S. should insist that our allies take the lead, such as in the Balkans?
Well, I certainly believe in burden sharing. I think that there's no question that American internationalism is not sustainable without our European allies sharing the burden. But this is a simple fact, and I say it with no jingoism, and that basically without the United States, these people cannot get their act together in terms of a military operation, whether it's the Gulf or Bosnia or Kosovo. That's a fact. And therefore, we are a European power. We have an interest in a stable European continent, and we are going to have to pay an inordinate share of this burden. But then again, we have a far inordinate share of the benefits. Take one more question.
There are several questions about your comments on the victims of globalization and how we should care about them. The simplest or maybe the most complicated is, what can we do for the victims of globalization? Another says that another wonders, what are the chances of this the have and have-nots turning into a new world war?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I argue in the book is that this era of globalization is going to be an era of civil wars between localizers and globalizers in all these societies. I think you can see that particularly in the Middle East, where you have very powerful traditional elements in these societies clinging to their olive trees, and you have now very modern global elements. And I see the tension there in my friends in the Middle East constantly. So I think that's going to be there. My basic argument in the book is as follows. I call myself, in the last chapter, I sort of laid out a new set of political identities, because I believe new system, you need new identities. Democrat, Republican doesn't really capture it anymore. And I call myself a radical integrationist social safety netter. And what I mean by that is the following. I believe you dare not be a globalizer today. You dare not be an advocate of free trade, integration, internet, you know, without being a social democrat. Because this isn't complicated, folks. You are never going to have the political consensus you need to sustain that openness. I only need to attention you to the debate about the WTO unless the have-nots, the no-nots, the left-behinds, or people who just are churned up by this system feel that at least someone is listening to their concerns, if not fully addressing them. But you dare not be a social democrat without also being a globalizer. Because in a world without walls, if you close off that world, you are never going to have the competitive edge, the knowledge base, or the growing economy you need to redistribute incomes or take care of the no-nots, the left-behinds, and the turtles without openness. That's why I believe in cushions, not walls. I believe in floors, not ceilings. I'm for protection, not protectionism. Thank you very much. I'll be signing the book outside.
That's fine. Thank you. Thank you. Our thanks to Tom Friedman, New York Times columnist and author of The Lexus and the Olive Tree, for joining us this afternoon. He will be signing books right outside. Thanks also to those here at the Hyatt Ricky's Palo Alto, as well as those listening on the radio. Now, this meeting of the Silicon Valley Forum of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.